This is Lisbeth Meredith, author of Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters, and you are listening to KODK 90.7 Kodiak, Alaska.
Walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Hello, and welcome to the November 2017 issue of Dog-Eared Reads, the homegrown radio show created by Kodiak Public Library Association and produced at the studios of KMXD Kodiak. I'm your host, Lori Madsen, happy to bring you this month's episode. In this month's show, I am delighted to share an interview that Tayton Sheridan did with author Lisbeth Meredith, who visited Kodiak last month and shared her stories, Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters. In our Roaring Over Amazing Read section, Bob Ross reviews two books about Antarctica that you'll find at our public library. This month's author spotlight is a shout-out to the Scandinavian Film and Culture Festival and its events that was held last week in Kodiak, many at the Kodiak Public Library. I'll be focusing on Frederick Bachman. Remember, Kodiak Public Library Association is a friends group to the Kodiak Public Library. We are here to support its missions, its programs, and to help with literacy in the community. I'm paraphrasing our mission statement, but we are there for all of Kodiak. And if you're interested in being a part of our organization, please get a membership. And also, if you are a member, we'd love to have you on our board. We have a current opening as someone had to step down. And then in the spring, we will have more openings as some of us have to move on. It's a real honor to serve on the Kodiak Public Library Association board, and we feel like we're doing good things to help support our library. So if you would like to get involved, you can check out our website at kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org, or you can contact a board member. Contact me, Lori Madsen, at 942-5552, or any other of your friends who may be serving on the board this term. Thanks so much. Well, let's get started with our show. Beyond the cover this evening, Tayton Sheridan interviews Lisbeth Meredith.
This is Tayton, and welcome to Beyond the Cover, our segment in Dog-Eared Reads, where we talk with authors, musicians, and other performers. On today's segment of Beyond the Cover, we'll chat with Anchorage, Alaska author Lisbeth Meredith. Meredith has a bachelor's degree in journalism and a master's in psychology, and has worked as a domestic violence advocate, a child abuse investigator, and as a juvenile probation supervisor with at-risk teens. She's the author of When Push Comes to Shove, How to Help When Someone You Love is Being Abused, and contributed to A Girl's Guide to Traveling Alone by Gemma Thompson. As described on her website, Meredith's most recent book, published in September 2016, a memoir titled Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters, recounts her two-year struggle to bring home her abducted daughters from Greece to Alaska. It's the story of a 29-year-old woman whose life was marked by domestic violence and childhood kidnapping. Since its publication, her book was listed as a 2016 USA Best Book Award finalist in the Women's Issues category, was a silver medalist for the 2017 Independent Publisher Book Awards in the Memoir Personal Struggles category, and was a finalist in the International Book Awards for Memoir. She's also a recipient of the Alaska Humanities Forum's mini-grant and won the Lynn Halterman Award from the Alaska Writers Guild. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and Meredith visited Kodiak on Saturday, October 28th to share her work and start a conversation about how we can all best respond to the epidemic of domestic violence. The presentation was at the Kodiak Public Library and was co-sponsored by Paul and Susan Gill, the Kodiak Women's Resource Crisis Center, and the Kodiak Public Library Association. We talked later that day in the KMXT studio. Lisbeth Meredith, welcome to Kodiak and the show.
Thank you so much, Tayton. I am thrilled to be here.
To start us off, for those who were unable to attend your presentation here in Kodiak or who haven't yet read your memoir, and without giving too much away, can you give us just a brief summary of the events you write about in Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters?
Thank you. I would love to. My book is primarily focused on my two-year struggle to get my internationally abducted daughters back from Greece to Alaska. They were taken as a retaliatory act of me leaving my abusive husband. And it was 4 years after I left him that he took the girls and went into hiding in Greece. And at that time, the state of Alaska, as particularly Anchorage, was amazing and supportive in helping me get my daughters back home. I had to really examine my own childhood, my childhood kidnapping, the family violence that went on, to be able to rescue my kidnapped daughters. And so the book looks at some of those things too, and largely talks about healing from intergenerational traumas and what a huge difference a supportive community can make, because I had great support here in Alaska and in Greece as well.
So I understand you have a passage that you could share with us to kind of get us going in our conversation.
I would love to. The prologue, it starts in 2016. Sometimes I'm asked if I feel lucky. Usually it's after I've given a presentation about domestic violence or the adverse childhood experiences study. And in the context of, aren't you glad all the bad stuff happened when your kids were little? As though pre-birth and early childhood experiences are any less impactful. The truth is I do feel lucky, but not because my kids were little when their father tried to kill me. I feel lucky because I survived and so did they. I feel lucky because when he stole them years later and took them to Greece, I was still a young adult with all the energy and optimism I needed to risk bringing them home. I feel lucky because I knew from living through my own kidnapping how important it was to right this wrong and was adept at developing a support network that would make doing so possible. I feel lucky that I recognized how much support the girls needed when they returned, and I often did my best to get it for them. And I feel lucky that my daughters have forgiven me for the decisions, large and small, that I've made that were not in their best interests. But there are times when I don't feel so lucky. When I take one of my daughters to the hospital for a trauma-related illness. When I am the only parent to hear their joys and sorrows. When I must reassure them, now in their late 20s, that I'm all right and that I'm still here for them after they become panicked when I've taken too long to return a text or a call. When I'm on a date and I'm asked anything about my marriage or how involved my kid's dad is in their lives. I never wanted to be one of those crime victims whose identity revolves around victimization. Then last year, I filled out a grant application and I listed my passions. Budget travel in foreign countries, writing, volunteering with literacy projects, all directly connected to surviving my victimization. I have my daughters, I have my passions, and all things considered, I guess that makes me better off than lucky.
That passage, certainly there's a lot of hope there, but also alludes to the rest of the book where it really is a long ordeal and quite the trauma. Before we get too many or into some of the other questions that go along with that, what did you gain in writing this book? And then what do you hope readers will gain from reading it?
I love that question. I love that question. Thank you. What I gained from writing it, which took over 2 decades, by the way, took over 2 decades for me to put this book together, but I gained a lot of perspective. There's something healing about writing when you can write down even traumatic events and you understand then that it is in fact the past. And so I gained some perspective, had some healing. I was able to really examine very closely some of the intergenerational themes that kept appearing in my life and also my journey toward help and healing. The ability to be able to share that with people, not because their daughters will be kidnapped, not because they will be a victim of domestic violence necessarily, although far too many people are, but all of us at some point or another will go through a trauma, there's no question, and will need to embrace recovery of some sort. And so it was a joy to be able to find my story in the homes and in the lives of people who then could look at and start talking about their own journey toward healing, toward wholeness, and toward recovery. Okay. And that's been a benefit.
Yeah. So that kind of leads to another question. So in the epilogue of your book, so kind of jumping to the end, you share the hope you had for resuming a normal life after right. rescuing your daughters, but then go on to write about how you learned later and now about the actual long-term consequences of domestic violence, childhood trauma, including some of the neuroscience and research. And you talked about that a little bit today in your presentation. Could you talk a little bit more about the long-term consequences of childhood trauma, these types of events, and then what it takes to recover, if that's even possible from these types of traumas?
I would love to do that, Tate, and thank you. I think it's so important to realize that back when I went to graduate school, which was more than a decade ago, we believed at some point in our history that when a person, you know, recovered from a trauma, especially if they were very, very little, that if they couldn't remember it, there was a certain benefit to that. Then maybe they'd go to play therapy or whatever, the situation would resolve and they would be unscathed perhaps. So I fully believed that as a young parent. When my kids returned, I was 31 years old and I thought, well, okay, good counseling plus sports, healthy adults in my daughter's lives, all of these great schooling, which we have fabulous schooling in Alaska, so great educators, great people in my community, all of that will resolve and where the girls will have a bright future and they'll express their own trauma and work through it and they will just move forward like a meteor. What I didn't realize was that a lot of times trauma gets kind of trapped in the body. And if it's not expressed, if it doesn't have a place to go, if there are too many toxic traumas for children, and I don't mean just any one bad thing, but I mean if there are too many toxic types of traumas for kids, that it can legitimately fester in the body and find its way into making health problems later on for middle-aged people even, that it can absolutely create much greater likelihood of substance abuse later on for those children, suicide attempts, being in a violent relationship, a lot of different horrible things, including a reduced life expectancy if they don't get the help that they need. Now, the good news is that help does exist, and being a part of a caring community like in Kodiak, there are a lot of people who want to do the right thing and have a healthy community. If people are surrounded by others who want to be a buffer, who want to listen, provide support, let the person know that they have a right to be treated well and that it's not their fault what has happened in the past, but there are services available, like at KWRCC, as an example, if it was domestic violence. It's amazing what can happen in that. People do not have to live and still kind of live in traumatic lives that continue to get worse and worse and worse, or repeat the mistakes of generations past. They can have a different future if they're willing to roll up their sleeves and really address some of these things, get the help that they need, and embrace recovery, really.
And that's the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you.
So as a new author, you've done a lot of the typical new author things, right? Marketing your book through readings, book reviews, your website. But then you've worked with organizations like the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center and partnered with social workers like you've done in some other communities I saw.
That's right.
To share your story and lead conversations with community members. And definitely today's event wasn't just a typical, you know, go and hear an author read and then get a book signing, but included that, but also a conversation about what is domestic violence and some of the stuff that we've already talked about today. What first prompted you to do an event like that? I think you said today this was your 65th event.
Right.
In Alaska, but also around the country. It sounded like you did an event in Kentucky and some other places too. So how would you describe the response that you've had, you and your partners and the people you've worked with, organizations or counselors or whoever? What's the response been like in communities?
It's so exciting because every community is different. Every agency that I have worked with is different also and want a different focal point. So as an example, coming to Kodiak, I knew and I was invited to be a part of the prayer vigil that it happens annually here for victims of domestic violence. And I loved that. And I was invited to be from Paul and Susan Gill to be a part of a greater conversation about how every part of the system could be more responsive in dealing with domestic violence. Even if you're a sibling or a friend or a family member, how do you make a difference? Because every one of us can make a difference in this issue. In Fairbanks, I did an event last winter, and unfortunately, right before I got to Barnes & Noble, there had been two different domestic violence homicides, and it was very traumatic. So when I had reached out to the women's shelter and the services there, I was able to go to a staff meeting and talk about what an incredible difference that the work that they do at this domestic violence agencies, what a difference that work does make, even sometimes when you don't get to see it, how much that is inspiring. And so that was a somber mood. Did one in Seward with a group, but everyone is a little bit different. It's so important to partner with great people who understand that keeping things secret, like domestic violence, like parental child kidnapping, sometimes even, you know, talking about mental health problems, things like that, that often we have a sense of shame about. Really, that sense of shame is part of what's making people sick. It's not that we go through problems, but it's the fact that we keep it private, we keep it silent, we fill ourselves with shame. And when we reach out and talk to each other, that isolation is removed. It's beautiful. It has been a beautiful run.
You're listening to Beyond the Cover and Dog-Eared Reads on KODK 90.7, and we're talking today with Anchorage, Alaska author Elizabeth Meredith, author of Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters. So let's switch gears here just a little bit then, and thinking about the aspiring nonfiction writers out there, Pieces of Me is a memoir, and writing about personal experience can be very hard. Talking about it can be hard, let alone writing about it, and then ultimately sharing it with others. We talked a little bit earlier about what you gained from writing and what you hoped readers would gain. Could you tell us a little bit more about the writing process that you had for Pieces of Me? You mentioned it took a couple of decades. And then the challenges that you faced in writing a memoir.
Absolutely. I would love to. It took a long time for me to figure out how to write. I had a journalism undergraduate degree by the time I started this book and eventually went on to get a graduate degree in psychology. But none of that really helped when it came to telling my personal story. And part of that was I was so untrained. I thought that writing one story meant you started at birth and you worked your way through till current time. It took me a long time to realize that a memoir is not all of a person's life. It is simply about a period of a transformation during the life, usually precipitated on one incident or something like that, but it is about a transformation, and that is the story. And so when I realized that was helpful, and I went to classes, I was in a critiquing group, I hired a writing coach at one point, but that was to work on a different novel. But I wanted to learn to write more book-worthy information. I would love to say that I woke up every day at 5 a.m. and wrote for an hour before I went to work, and that was not true. When I came home and when I started this process, my kids were traumatized. They were young. They were busy then, and they had sports, and we had counseling and so many other things. I had a job, school sometimes, myself. So I wrote when I could, and I tried not to shame myself about that or feel too bad. And, you know, definitely as the girls got older, I had more time to devote to writing. And then at some point when I realized where the story was, where it began and where it ended, then I got super serious about it. By that point, unfortunately, the entire publishing world had changed underneath me. So if I would have published my book way back when the events happened, and I must say it would have been a much different book then because my perspective has changed, but it was profitable then. But I waited until we could make sure that I would make zero money and wrote this book at a time when it was hard to get memoir published. There had been a lot of scandals about people writing things that weren't true, publishing as nonfiction, and now it made it impossible for memoirists. So that was a real challenge, just learning to write it. And then by the time that I figured that out, finding that nobody was all that interested in a non-Kardashian telling their life story. So that was a barrier. I kind of borrowed from when the girls were gone to Greece. I used to say when the crisis was happening, I never said to myself, is it possible to bring the girls home from Greece? I said, how will we make the girls? How will we bring them home from Greece? How will they come safely home? In writing, as hard as it was, there are nearly 1 million books a year published now. Not will this book be published, but how will it be published? And so I worked on that and made sure that I looked at every possible option. And by the time that I finally got the drafts in place and had a publisher saying, yes, I think we'd like that, I think it all came together at the right time. What I didn't expect all these years later was that the book would be published at a time when people needed to be reminded of how wonderful life can be when we talk to each other rather than at each other, when people who have absolutely nothing in common set aside their differences to work together for a common goal. There's nothing we can't achieve together. And that was kind of an unexpected gift that came.
You talked about how the landscape has changed for writers, for memoirs, with some of the things with publishing in general. So would you have any advice then for those aspiring writers? You know, maybe they're putting together something like yours that's dealing with pretty close and tough experiences or just experiences in general.
I think one piece of advice, just like in dealing with a trauma, dealing with people, sometimes we do better in groups than we do alone. Writing is a very solitary process. It takes a lot of introspection to be able to do it. But it's really fabulous when you find, whether it's online or locally, a critiquing buddy, a critiquing group, writing group. That can be a really helpful thing. Write your first draft as though nobody will ever see it but you. Don't worry about getting it published. Don't worry about legal lawsuits initially. Don't worry about offending people. Write whatever it is that you have to write. Write it all unabashedly, unvarnished. Just do it. And then after that draft, then start looking at, okay, I see all of this stuff I wrote. My book itself had 100 extra pages that had to be cut away. Here, wrote all of this stuff. Where is the story now? Where is the real story? And don't be shy about going online or going to local resources, the university, writing classes, whatever, hiring a writing coach, if it's important to you and it's something you want to share, by all means, find help to do that. I was a part of what's called a Write Your Memoir in 6 Month group. It was like $80 for 6 weeks of a course. But those links, the course link, I worked during the day. They'd send me recorded information about the class after I got off work. That was very affordable. And just those kinds of things, like don't give up. Everyone's writing the first draft is horrible, and that to be expected. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It took a village to bring my kids home from Greece. It took even bigger village to get this memoir, 2 years in the making, to be the book that it turned out to be. It took a lot of help. I'm not Ernest Hemingway by any stretch, but it's just for all of us. Practice, practice, practice. Keep doing it, and it will improve.
So some good inspiration for those writers out there who are still working on the book, maybe after a couple decades. It can happen.
Absolutely it can.
So we have just a time for a couple more questions then. Do you have any book recommendations for our listeners, whether stories similar to yours that have inspired you, or maybe just resources out there for those who might want to learn more about domestic violence issues or traumas?
Absolutely. So in fact, now that you mentioned that, I do have a website with a whole bunch of resources, a whole resource page for writing, for domestic violence, even for childhood kidnapping, all of those things. So feel free at lameredith.com. The things that I like to refer people to for writing, as an example, if they're writing memoir, National Association of Memoir Writers has a free teleconference every month where people can call in and coach and encourage each other. I'm a big group support fan, kind of like group therapy for writers. And actually, the person who leads it is a therapist. So it is sort of group therapy. The local Writers Guild, fabulous support, all of that. There are many online resources. For books that I love, there are so many books that I love. But one book I'm reading right now, in fact, is called Loving Lindsay. And it is by a woman named Linda Atwell, who wrote about her special needs daughter, and it is just absolutely beautiful. I read Chantal Pence, an Alaskan woman who wrote Homestead Girl, and another book that I really, really liked, Whisper Mama, is a novel by an Alaskan author also. She goes by her initials, but again, I'll have some reference to this on my author website. But Whisper Mama is a fabulous book that's available, so I'm enjoying that. I really like Sherman Alexie. If you're familiar with Sherman Alexie, and a lot of what he's written that's my favorite was written as a novel, even though it was nonfiction. And so I was just right before this trip looking over some of his work and thinking he has a beautiful but spare way of relaying so much emotion in so few words. So I just love that. But I think for all of us, we just have to keep writing and trying, writing and trying. And one of the best things a writer can do is read. And read a whole bunch of books and go to your library. Go to the library often. Check out books. See what you like that's similar, that's different, all of that. And speaking of the library, really appreciate your local library having a few copies of my book. So I'm very thankful to Kodiak and KPLA. But yeah, there's all kinds of resources, whether you're in looking for recovery or whether you're looking toward writing, which is, again, kind of can be another step toward recovery.
So in your blog post, actually September 20th of 2017, which also happened to be, I guess, 1 year after your book was launched,
that's right.
You mentioned that it'll soon be time to slow down, right? We talked about earlier, you've done 65 of these events about your book, to slow down and work on your next book, and you've already pitched it to a literary agent who deemed it the most promising manuscript. Can you tell us a little bit about your plans for your next book? Is it another memoir or something else?
I would love it. And I just need to clarify, she found it to be the most promising manuscript of that weekend. So I just wanted to, I was at a writer's conference. It was still a great boon though. I was so excited, very excited. So I've started writing a trilogy. Hopefully it will end up being a trilogy. The first novel is completely finished and it follows a middle-aged character, a woman, a single mom, who reminds me somewhat of myself, who's raising two daughters. Her daughters basically sit her down for an intervention as they're getting older, about to graduate and move on, and say basically, look, we've been taking turns staying home with you because you are lonely and pathetic. You will only get older from here. We're about to fly the coop. You better find the man of your dreams find that relationship, because you're not going to become any more attractive than you are now. In fact, you're dwindling quickly, but get out there and get it done. And so my own daughters had a similar conversation with me, but then it made me realize, There are a lot of women who could relate to somebody going on a quest to find the man of their dreams, only to realize that maybe their energy could be well spent becoming the woman of her dreams. And a relationship may or may not follow, but, you know, it kind of follows a fun journey. And it was a huge break to leave writing about things like domestic violence and childhood kidnapping and going toward the funnier, lighter side of life, but that still had some moments of being poignant. So this trilogy will follow a character named Tilka in her 40s, her 50s, and her 60s.
Okay, so a trilogy right there to look forward to.
That's right. Thank you.
Well, Elizabeth Meredith, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today, for coming to Kodiak and putting on an event here, and for talking with us today.
Tayton, thank you so much for having me, and I'm so incredibly grateful to the people of Kodiak, to Paul and Susan Gill, to KWRCC, to KPLA, and the library in general. I've been so touched, and I'm very thankful for the Bears that came out and let me see for the first time that I've been to Kodiak, and have come a number of times. I got to see such a great Bear show while I've been here, so what a joy.
Meredith's book, Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters, is available for purchase through online booksellers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Copies are also available for checkout at the Kodiak Public Library, and you can learn more about the author and read her blog at www.lameredith, that's lameredith.com. To learn more about the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center, which serves all of Kodiak Island Borough, not just the city, but the entire borough, visit www.kwrcc.org, like them on Facebook, or give them a call at 907-486-6171. This is Tayton. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Cover and Dog-Eared Reads. Until next time, happy reading.
Thank you, Tayton. That was very interesting. This month's author spotlight is in honor of the Scandinavian Film and Culture Festival events that were held in early November in Kodiak, many at the Kodiak Public Libraries. When I think of Swedish authors, I think of Henning Mankell, author of the well-known Wallander series, or Stieg Larsson, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and that series. Both authors write with a darkness that might be described as Scandinavian noir. But after reading Frederick Backman, I have a different idea. His humor is often very deep and carries lots of meaning for life. For example, quote, "Death is a strange thing. People live their whole lives as if it does not exist, and yet it's often one of the great motivations for the living. Some of us, in time, become so conscious of it that we live harder, more obstinately, with more fury. Some need its constant presence to even be aware of its antithesis. Others become so preoccupied with it that they go into the waiting room long before it has announced its arrival. We fear it, yet most of us fear more than anything else that it may take someone other than ourselves, for the greatest fear of death is always that it will pass us by and leave us there alone." End quote. Meet Uwe. He's a curmudgeon, the kind of man who points at people he dislikes as if they were burglars caught outside his bedroom window. He has staunch principles, strict routines, and a short fuse. People call him the bitter neighbor from hell, but must Ove be bitter? Just because he doesn't walk around with a smile plastered on his face all the time? Behind the cranky exterior, there's a story and a sadness. So when one November morning, a chatty young couple with two chatty young daughters move in next door and accidentally flatten Uwe's mailbox, it is the lead-in to a comical and heartwarming tale of unkempt cats, unexpected friendship, and the ancient art of backing up a U-Haul, all of which will change one cranky old man and a local residents' association to their very foundations. Frederick Backman got a tepid response when he sent out the manuscript for his debut novel, A Man Called Uwe. Most publishers ignored him, and several even turned him down. After a few months and a few more rejections, Backman began to think that maybe there wasn't a market for a story about a cranky old 59-year-old Swedish widower who tries and fails to kill himself. It was rejected by publishers with the line, "We like your novel, we think your writing has potential, but we see no commercial potential." Frederick Backman, who's in his mid-30s, lives outside of Stockholm, Sweden, with his wife and two children. Uwe has become a blockbuster. It's sold more than 2.8 million copies worldwide, making it one of Sweden's most popular literary exports since The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. A Man Called Uwe has been adapted into a successful movie, and it recently opened, which recently opened in the United States. Translation rights for the books have sold in 38 languages, including Thai, Japanese, Latvian, and Korean. Mr. Bachman has gained a passionate fan base in South Korea, where the novel has become a huge bestseller. Bachman said, "No one really knows why," in a recent telephone interview. "Not even the Korean publisher understands what the heck is going on." Bachman's Swedish publisher has said that, "I think Fredrik is different from the dark crime writers and doing something different from writers in general. He has such a distinctive voice and a point of view. He might be the herald of a larger trend in Scandinavian literature, but I think he's doing his own thing. There's a certain charm when it comes from his Swedish heritage that I don't think that's what's driving interest here." Another, I found a podcast called Author Stories Podcast with Hank Carter. I have included it in this author spotlight so you can hear the voice of Fredrik Bachman as he talks about writing, the writing process, and why he writes about what he does. In another quote from a man called Uwe, "Uwe feels an instinctive skepticism towards all people taller than 6 feet. The blood can't quite make it all the way up to the brain." A little comic relief from Fredrik Bachman.
You know, my first big storytelling experience was The Brothers Lionheart by Astrid Lindgren. My mother read that to me when I was 6. My grandfather had just passed away. And my mother, cleverly enough, she thought that she would read it's a storybook for children, but it's a big adventure about death and this place where two kids get when they die, and there's a ton of adventures there. And she read that to me, probably to open up for questions about death. I think I decided to become a storyteller. It's just that had such a huge impact on me, what stories could do, that I could probably propel. And then after that, the whole thing with writing was just that I was a weird kid. So I had a problem with communicating with... No, I had a problem communicating with people, and I was always... You know, I was always too much or too little. It was always, there are no in-between levels with me. I'm either zero or 100 all of the time. And I kind of figured out somewhere and when I was like 7 or 8 or 9 or something that if I write things down, I can edit it. And it's easier for me to communicate with people. And so I started, whenever I was angry at my dad or something, I would leave him a stern letter, so we wouldn't fight. We would have these really, really angry conversations via post, which probably carried on. We still communicate mostly. We live in the same building, but we still communicate mostly through email and texts.
And what I've read of your writing in A Man Called Uwe and now in Beartown that I'm reading, you really tackle these difficult subjects, but sometimes wrap them in a little bit of humor or in kind of the dressings of mundane life that allow us to kind of all relate to the stories while getting to something deeper. Is that something conscious that you do, or is that just grown out of, you know, that thing that started with your mother?
No, I don't know. I don't know where stories come from, and I don't purposely set out to do one thing or another. I think I like a lot of different kind of stories, so it's kind of natural that I try to write different kinds of stories. Yeah. I think, I mean, the breakthrough for me as a writer came when I understood that I wasn't special, because up until that point, you know, when you're young and you're trying to write stuff, you're trying to be super original. That's your whole, well, I have to write something that no one has ever done before. And right. You try to be super deep and super, and you try to be something you're not. And then, you know, my breakthrough was when I figured out that I'm a very, very normal person. I live a very, very normal, uninteresting life. And that's my thing. That's what I got going for me, because when I write things that I like, the chances are good that a lot of other people will as well, because taste is probably pretty close to a lot of people's taste. So I think that was my breakthrough, really, that I figured out that I don't have to be tried to be something I'm not. But there was a writer who said that you know, a book can break any rules as long as it's alive. That's what I'm going for all the time. I'm not trying to do everything like someone would teach it. It's just I'm trying to write something that I feel something for, and I'm trying to just get that same feeling across to someone else.
I think a lot of people would take comfort in knowing that someone that's had the amount of success that you've had and has written books that are so powerful and resonate with readers so well, that it, you know, even on your fifth book, you know, it's still a chore and a struggle sometimes to get the story right and to find out exactly what it is that you want to say. I think a lot of people will take comfort in that.
No, but it is. I mean, that's the craft. I mean, it's, I don't mean to sound pretentious or anything, but I keep putting myself in a position where I'm stressed or where I have deadlines or where I'm like, I have to finish the book. And people ask me like, well, why do you have to write? You know, why do you do it? Why do you, you know, why do it if it's hard? I'm like, well, you need to do it because it's hard. That's the craft. That's the thing. And the thing is that whenever you're comfortable, whenever you feel like, oh, I'm writing a story now that I have, that I could write in my sleep, that, you know, it's not hard anymore. It's not, then you need to write something else because you're not evolving and you're not feeling anything. And it's supposed to be hard. Because when you read a really good novel, if you read something that really means something to you, you feel something. You have all these powerful emotions. I mean, and in order to make a reader cry, I can't think of a way that someone would read a book and cry if the author didn't cry writing it. I can't Right. think of a way that would work. I think Grant Morrison, who wrote Batman. It's, what do you call it? The comics, the Batman comics. Yeah, he was, and he's done a bunch of other. And I mean, he's fantastic. I think there's this documentary about him where he said someone asked him like, how is that possible that you would write something that would make me, who have never met you, cry. And he said, I don't remember the exact quote, but he said something like, I can only assume that that's an extension of me crying when I wrote it. You know, that's really hard to explain to people. And it's really hard to explain when people who want to write, want to tell stories, and they ask, like, how do I become a writer? Well, you write. That's the only way. I mean, how do I get my book published? I mean, don't worry so much about getting your book published. Write the book and right. feel something for it. Because, and that's the hard part. And that's why it's difficult. And that's why it doesn't matter if you've written. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's my fifth novel, because it's still really hard, because it's still, you know, it's still me trying to feel things that are difficult. Yeah. And digging into parts of yourself that you might not. Most people don't go to work aspiring to make themselves cry, so that's a weird job, and you're gonna, you know, there're gonna be days when that's, you know, it's really hard to write something that's yeah. horrible or really heart-wrenching for you as a writer, and then you know, and then it's 5 o'clock, and you go pick up the kids, and you go home, and you try to have a normal family life. Sometimes that. You know, that's hard, and it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And that's the job. That's the craft. I think I'll get worried if I start feeling that it's easy. I think I'll sure. that'll worry me if I start feeling that, this is not hard anymore, because then there's something wrong. And if I don't care, no one else will. I think that's right. It's hard for everyone, and I think writers, experienced writers sometimes don't do new writers, up-and-coming writers, any favors, because some writers give off this perception that writing is easy at some point, that there's going to be a day where, oh, now you're successful, so now it's easy. It's never easy. If you want to do something good, something that people actually care about, that's never easy. It's still scary, and, you know, you always, I always, always think that this book that I'm writing right now is going to be my last. This is what's going to end my career. You know, you always have this feel that this is people find out that I'm a fraud, that I don't really know what the hell I'm doing. This is where they found out. This is where they call my bluff. And that makes you work harder. That makes you go back and edit it one more time. And that makes you think about it harder and question yourself and, you know, Google that last piece of research.
Or even if you get past thinking I'm a fraud, you know, a lot of times as writers will think, I could never write another book after this. I've put every idea I've ever had about everything into this book. What else could I ever write about? And then that book is finished, and then ideas just seem to come out of nowhere. And it's funny how that works.
Yeah, because I think ideas make more ideas. I think that's how creativity works. That's my only theory. That you know, you can't hold on to ideas. You have to. You have to give everything you got. I mean, it's like sports. Right. I mean, you can't go into a game and thinking about the next game. You have to play this game, and you have to give this game everything you've got. And that's the only way of doing it. At least for me. I don't know how. But I mean, you're supposed to be, when you finish the book, you're supposed to be all out. Like, you're supposed to have this feeling of, I'm done. But then you go to bed, you go up the next morning, and you're thinking, now what? And you start all over again. And that's what makes it, you know, that it makes it very, very hard to understand for people who don't love writing. But it's very, very easy to understand for people who do. That why would you do that? Why would you put yourself through that, you know, mentally and emotionally, just draining yourself of every emotion, and then as soon as it's done, you go up the next day and you're like, well, you know, off to the next one. And you do it all over again. Like, why would you put yourself through that? Because it's a love. It's just... this is the only thing that I've ever wanted to do, really. It's fun, and it's you know, it's not always easy, but it's still you know, it's a passion, and I think people either understand that or they don't. They either have that in themselves or they don't, and that's just the way it is.
Let's talk about your new book for a minute, Bear Town. Sure. First off, this book is absolutely gorgeous in its look. The cover design is phenomenal and instantly kind of sets you in a mood. But when I cracked the book open, the entire first chapter is two sentences long, and it begins like this. Late one evening toward the end of March, a teenager picked up a double-barreled shotgun, walked into the forest, put the gun to someone else's forehead, and pulled the trigger. This is the story of how we got there. That opening, you know, paragraph, the two sentences, just absolutely wrecked me. In that I was completely hooked. There's no way I could not read that book after that. That was kind of where did the idea to tell this story? It's a little bit different storytelling than you've done in the past, in that you the central character is a town instead of this one person that you're following and kind of, you know, peeling back the layers of. What made you want to tell this kind of story?
That's really hard to explain. I had this idea that I wanted to tell a story about sports. I wanted to tell a story about, you know, what it meant, what it has meant for me growing up, because sports is just, I fell in love with sports at the same time I fell in love with books, because they're stories. I mean, sports are stories. Stories you'll ever find in sports. I mean, the life stories, that's where you get it. But I also wanted to tell something about, you know, the darker side of sports, the darker side of this elite thinking and you know, win or die attitude that surrounded me so much when I did sports. And, you know, out of that grew an idea that I might be able to tell a story about a town. So I can tell a lot of different stories, you know, that intertwine with each other. And I had never done that. This actually started, the original idea was a screenplay for a TV series. So I started writing it as a script. And I think that, you know, if you read the book, knowing that, that probably shines through a little bit that, oh, this was originally thought as a TV series, because this was, you know, because there's a lot of different characters and we move out in and out of scenes. It's written really in scenes, and there's a lot of dialogue and you know, I wrote 4 episodes, I think, and then I just realized that I couldn't work with TV people. It was just horrible, because it takes so long for a decision to be made. There are so many things that just kills the creative process. I mean, it kills it. And at that point, I think my wife and my agent and, you know, everyone around me who knows me said, well, maybe just go sit alone in a room and write it as a novel, just the way you want it, and then we'll talk to the TV people. And so that's what I did. So I just decided to write it as a novel instead. And that was also, you know, you find little things. This was the first time that I had multiple viewing points, because up until this point, I had only written about one character, and we follow that character all through the book. So it's just, you know, it's one camera, so to speak. And this was something else, that I have 10, 12, 15 characters that I swap between them. And, you know, and you find out little things that you have, you know, you have less time to build each character. So you have to be more to the point. You have to be more specific with each one. But you also find out that, wow, when you all only have one character, movement takes a lot of time. And that's something that I just discovered. And that's my, you know, my fifth novel. And that's a discovery that you can make. So, wow, movement takes a lot of time. If you're only going to write about one character, you have this, oh, so this character is going to the store now. Okay, and the next scene is in the store. Do I need to tell the readers how this character got to the store? Do we need to be in the car with the character? Do we need to be there when the character decides to go to the store? Is that important? You know, how much? Because you can't just jump with, if you have one character, you can't just all of a sudden he's at the store. That doesn't work. You have to have a flow to it. And that takes a lot of time and energy to just move that character around. But as soon as you have multiple characters, it's, well, this character is at home, and now we switch to another character. When we get back, this character is at the store. And people are going to be, the reader is going to be fine with that, because, well, we left him and he went to the store, apparently, and now it's at the store. That's fine. So it's little things like that that makes it, you realize, like, wow, I'm still learning so much. You know, fifth novel, I'm still having these huge realizations that wow, this is how it works. This is how this kind of storytelling works. That's a kick.
Absolutely. Beartown is an absolutely stunning book. It is. I told you it captivated me from page one and carries all the way through. It's so familiar, and I think that goes back to what you said at the beginning about, you know, writing the instead of trying to do the thing that no one else has done, do the thing that everyone knows, but do it so well and anchor it so deeply that the reader just falls right into the story. Like it's so immersive. I just wanted to, thank you for the book. I think it's absolutely stunning, and I think it will be as huge a success as your previous works. I encourage everyone to go out and get a copy of Beartown.
That was excerpted from episode 198 of the Authors Stories Podcast with Hank Garner, focusing on Frederick Bachman. This month's author spotlight on Dog-Eared Reads. People in the real world always say when something terrible happens that the sadness and loss and aching pain of the heart will lessen as time passes. But it isn't true. Sorrow and loss are constant, but if we all had to go through our whole lives carrying them the whole time, we wouldn't be able to stand it. The sadness would paralyze us. So in the end, we just pack it into bags and find somewhere to leave it. That's a quote from My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry, another bestseller by Frederick Bachman. Our public library has several Bachman books, and A Man Called Uwe, My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry, and this newest one, Beartown, and Every Morning the Way Home Gets Longer and Longer, can also be found on the new bookshelf at our Kodiak Public Library. Yes, and I hope you'll check one of those out. Next up, we have Bob Ross reviewing two books on Antarctica that I hope you'll find interesting. Here's Bob, roaring over amazing reads.
Welcome to yet another in a series of book reviews from the archives of the Kodiak Public Library. I'm Bob Ross, and it is my pleasure to take you on an armchair journey to the frosty Antarctic with two books covering Sir Ernest Henry Shackleton's second expedition there. Both books reviewed are by author Jennifer Armstrong. The Spirit of Endurance, the True Story of the Shackleton Expedition to the Antarctic, is a 32-page oversized volume copiously illustrated by William Maugin, and although written for children, it is very much of interest even to my youthful 89 years. I found it easy to be drawn through space and time into the action of Shackleton's world with Maugin's paintings and the large expedition photographs. Armstrong gives a solid Reader's Digest account of the second expedition without the reader feeling rushed or rationed. This book is a 2000 publication of Crown Publishers. Shipwreck at the Bottom of the World, The Extraordinary True Story of Shackleton and the Endurance, is a 134-page Scholastic Incorporated 1998 publication. By contrast, it uses extensive expedition photographs and maps and a flowing narrative to be, to this reader, the Paul Harvey rest of the story on Sir Ernest Shackleton's second Antarctic expedition. This book is found in the juvenile reading section of the library, but like The Spirit of Endurance, it is a fascinating read far beyond that age group. I found the reading of The Spirit of Endurance first prepared and helped me to more significantly appreciate the content of Shipwreck to the Bottom of the World, say, as an outline, gives direction to a greater work. In Kodiak, we are not strangers to bad weather. Winds of 60 miles an hour and gusts to 80 are not common, but not unusual. So to set the tone for these books, the first three paragraphs constituting page one from Shipwreck at the Bottom of the World is read. Quote, just imagine yourself in the most hostile place on earth. It is not the Sierra or the Gobi Desert. It is not the Arctic. The most hostile place on earth is the Antarctic, the location of the South Pole. North Pole? South Pole? What's the difference? The Arctic is mostly water with ice on top, of course, and that ice is never more than a few feet thick. But under the South Pole lies a continent that supports glaciers up to 2 miles in depth. Almost the entire southern continent is covered in ice. This mammoth ice cap presses down so heavily that it actually distorts the shape of the Earth. The ice never melts. It clings to the bottom of the world, spawning winds, storms, and weather that affect the entire planet. And of all the weather that it creates, the weather the Antarctic creates for itself is by far the worst. In the winter, the temperatures can sink to 100 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Cold weather masses sliding down the sides of glaciers speed up until they become winds of close to 200 miles per hour. When winter descends on the southern continent, the seas surrounding the land begin to freeze at a terrifying rate of 2 square miles every minute, until the frozen sea reaches an area of 7 million miles, about twice the size of the United States. It is truly the most hostile environment this side of the moon. Just imagine yourself being stranded in such a place. In 1915, a British crew of 28 men was stranded there with no ship and no way to contact the outside world. They all survived, unquote. For me, it is hard to think of Shackleton's second expedition by itself. This is a case of the whole being much greater than the sum of its parts. In sole terms of accomplishing expedition goals, not even one of his Antarctic expeditions was successful. His first expedition was to reach the South Pole. In 1908, he became the first explorer to get within 100 miles of the South Pole. He was knighted by his king for this accomplishment. His second expedition in 1914 was to be the first traverse of the Antarctic continent. Winter ice locked his ship 100 miles from the Antarctic landmass, the scheduled traverse start point, and changed his expedition goal from exploration to that one solely for survival. His third expedition saw his death en route to Antarctic in 1926, and he is buried on South Georgia Island. Survival in the face of insurmountable odds is then the true story of Shackleton's second expedition to the Antarctic. Trapped in the ice, their ship is crushed. They endure more than a year of Antarctic weather. They escape by their own means with only their clothes, supplies, and materials they can carry, the game they can hunt, by their own collective talents, and the wits of their leader. Shackleton's expedition made the longest recorded small boat open water sailing in Antarctic history and saw the first traverse of the mountains of South Georgia Island in their final quest to obtain help from the whaling station on that island. This is more than one explorer's adventure. This is an epic struggle for survival that rivals the greatest Indiana Jones fictitious action-adventure film of our day, where every minute courts disaster and death. This larger-than-life true story of human survival in extreme circumstances make these well-documented books well worth the read. I hope you have enjoyed this month's book review on Shackleton's second Antarctic expedition. The book titles are Spirit of Endurance and Shipwreck at the Bottom of the World, both by author Jennifer Armstrong. Until our next book review, I'm Bob Ross, and it has been my pleasure to share this time with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. We appreciate your volunteering to read book reviews for our radio show. If you'd like to share a book review, please contact us at kpla.alaska@gmail.com. We'll not only put you on the air, we'll get you involved in our organization. Thank you. And thank you for listening to this month's Dog-Eared Reads, KPLA's radio show, put on by volunteers for your listening pleasure. Happy reading!
Heaven in your breath, the simplest of pleasures, the world at its base.